Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show with Jefferson Lilly on mobile home park investing. Dan Breslin here, your REI Diamond Show host. Today, Jefferson and I are going to dive into the reasons why he believes mobile home parks are the absolute best real estate investment. Jefferson manages a few funds, has a few funds open. Jefferson's funds currently own and manage more than 1,500 pads, that is mobile home parking spaces, which are where the homes are located, obviously, and is actively seeking more. We cover everything from financing to partnership structures in this episode and even touch on a few mobile home park cash flow improvement strategies. So let's jump right in. And welcome to the show, Mr. Jefferson Lilly. How are you doing today?
I'm great, Dan. How are you?
Fantastic. I am recording here live from Philadelphia, which was my hometown. A lot of my listeners know I moved to Chicago so I can hang out with my daughter all the time where she lives. This is kind of a dream for me for years. For 10 years straight, she lived 700 miles away, and it was a chance for us to kind of do the opposite. You could figure how, you know, when she's small, she would come for the weekends and a week for the summer, maybe 2 weeks. And for us, it was kind of like a real cool thing. This was one of my goals written down like a long time ago, you know, when we're defining success and things. My goal, Jefferson, was to take the vacation in the opposite direction from Chicago with my daughter to visit family someday. And we were on that vacation slash work trip as we speak. So things are really good. How about yourself?
You know, I'm great. I'll just throw out that I was actually born and educated in Philly. So I guess I got to ask you, are you a Pats or a Geno's steak guy?
I think I'm a Geno's. My daughter, she likes to go to pretty much any of them. She's not quite loyal, but I definitely like Geno's. How about you?
I started out a Pats guy. I still like both the food, but I think Geno's, I like the ambiance a little better over there. It's like a little more fun. And of course, you're always sitting outside. Anyway, but it's all good food down there in South Philly if you're into cheesesteaks.
Absolutely. Yeah, can't wait to get started. Jefferson, for listeners who don't know who you are already, can you kind of give us an idea maybe where you're recording from, where you live now, and sort of what led up to your business today?
Sure, yeah. I'm coming to you live from San Francisco. I've been out here, I don't know, 18 years now, something like that, since actually doing grad school there in Philly at Wharton. I got into this business. I actually came out to San Francisco after business school to do the dot-com thing and kind of rode that up, down, and sideways, went through the dot-com boom and bust. But then got basically more focused on value investing and started moving away from all the sort of sexy high-tech, biotech, solar tech, silly tech investing.
Nice.
And real estate falls into that. And my worldview, we'll get into this on your show here, I'm sure, but my worldview is that mobile home parks are the single best niche in real estate. They are traditional, you know, value investing, where, as Warren Buffett would say, we're buying dollars for 50 cents. It's a very repeatable business model, unlike virtually everything in the high tech world here in Silicon Valley. So I actually bought my first park just as a side investment when I was still working at that third startup. I could see after a year that my startup was not doing real well, but my mobile home park was doing reasonably well, and I was putting no time or money into it. So I switched over, and I guess the rest is history. It's been about a decade now that I've been buying mobile home parks. I've now, with my partner Brad Johnson, we've started a mobile home park fund, and we're currently, I believe, about the 59th largest mobile home park owner, soon to be in the top 50. So we own 19 parks, about 1,500 pads nationwide, and have about another 700 pads under contract.
It sounds like you're hitting a point where you're scaling up the number of units very rapidly. Do you want to talk about why you believe these park investments are, you know, the best niche value investment opportunity in real estate right now? Can you give us a little background?
Yeah, sure. Probably a lot of your listeners would be familiar with buying either apartment buildings or single family houses. So let's start with that as a frame of reference. So, you know, real estate, that kind of real estate, most kinds of real estate can be good investments because, you know, if you buy it right and you buy it with some leverage, the leverage is going to help you. You're going to do well. You, of course, get depreciation to shield your income. And mobile home parks offer all that, but mobile home parks offer more. So the more is that in our world, almost all of our tenants own their own mobile homes. So the implications there are significant. First, our tenant base has separated wheat from chaff, so to speak. Our tenants maybe have moved up out of being apartment dwellers or renting single family homes. And they, again, they now own their own mobile home. Might not be as nice of a home as you or I live in, but Dan, they do exhibit pride of ownership. And they, of course, now maintain all those proverbial leaky toilets and leaky roofs. Again, we really don't own the mobile homes in our communities. So we view this business, frankly, really as being like a parking lot business. We just rent out the land and, again, collect rents from more responsible tenants that own their own homes. Another implication from them owning the home is that they tend not to move them. Mobile homes, a single wide, would almost certainly be at least $4,000 to move, even, you know, within the same city. A double wide mobile home would cost about twice that. And that's just too much money. So really, the homes tend to stay in place for about 50 years. That's probably even a conservative, useful life. So if somebody wants to move to another city, unlike an apartment renter where they just sort of pack up and go and maybe, you know, you have a month or a couple months of vacancy. If our folks pack up and go, they're almost certainly still paying the rent on that mobile home because we do have a mechanics lien on the house. Otherwise, we can put a lien on it. So even if they've gone, you know, they'll advertise on Craigslist, they'll find some new tenant to buy it from them, and then that new tenant moves in. Our turnover, you know, I'm not saying we never get stiffed for rent, but our turnover is dramatically lower than traditional apartment building tenants or, again, renting out single-family homes. Those folks tend to turn over, I think, about every 2 years or three. In our world, the tenant really is the home, and homes, again, tend to last for, call it, 50 years. So we're way down into the single-digit range of turnover. Those homes tend to stay in place, and somebody is paying rent on it. And then finally, I'll just throw out another thing that makes this the best thing going, is that it's now illegal to build any more mobile home parks. Let's say it's against zoning. Maybe I shouldn't say really illegal. But basically, pretty much every city and county has changed the zoning and made it, you know, not legal, not acceptable to build any more mobile homes. So that's a tremendous competitive advantage. That's a great business to be in. When you're in the mobile home park business, you're participating in a government-enforced oligopoly. You're not a monopolist. You will have competition, but there'll just never be any more competition. And probably about 1% of mobile home parks get plowed under every year and become some higher and better use. They become a sexy apartment building or a shopping mall or self-storage or whatever. So not only do you have growing demand, roughly 1% right along with population growth, you have shrinking supply. And all those 1% of the folks in existing mobile home parks that are getting displaced, those guys and gals have to go somewhere. So that also creates demand simply because other parks slowly but surely are going away. So that's why this is a much better business than most any other niche of real estate I've ever heard of.
Interesting. So what is the depreciation? Because this is what, a 90% land and 10% infrastructure type of thing? I mean, give me an example of depreciation on a mobile home park.
Yeah, would you believe 80%? Even better than most apartment buildings and other forms of real estate. Yeah, so I understand. I get that question a lot, like, hey, Jefferson, sounds like a great business, but yeah, it's just raw land, so you can't really have any depreciation. You know, if it were raw land, you know, of course, there'd be no roads, there'd be no water or sewer pipe, there'd be no fences, there'd be no signage. All of those things are depreciable. The pipes, I believe, are 27 and a half years, so that's as quote-unquote bad as traditional bricks and mortar. But roads are 20-year property. Fencing and signage, I believe, is 7-year. And then, frankly, and you know, if you run out of assets, so to speak, run out of improvements to the land, then the rest of your purchase price gets allocated to goodwill. and goodwill is amortized over 15 years. So on average, we're taking down 75 to 80% of our purchase price. We're taking it down over, on average, like 16 or 17 years. So that compares even more, quite favorably, again, to traditional apartment building investing, where you might take down 75 or 80%, but have to do it over more like 27 and a half years.
So while we're on the depreciation question, we're probably going to kind of switch gears, but I do have a couple other questions I want to swing back to first. But to stay on topic with this one, if you raise money, and I don't want to get into the entire raising money structure on this question because I know we're going to get there shortly, but if you raise money from several people, is the depreciation spread out amongst the investors, or is that, you know, amongst the investors in the fund, or is that taken at the company level?
No, we spread that out. Yeah. Park Street Partners, our company, is, for tax purposes, it doesn't exist. Everything passes through. All earnings and depreciation gets split up. You know, Brad and I, my partner, take some of it, and the rest of it gets passed through to our investors. So, yeah, they absolutely benefit from depreciation.
And why is it, I mean, I'm going to guess, oh, they just don't want the mobile home parks, but is there some other reason why it's, you know, been outlawed by zoning methodically by almost every county in the country?
Yeah. So what you've got is a real NIMBY, you know, not in my backyard type mentality from, again, pretty much every city and county, you know, town council. And mobile home parks are viewed, I think, incorrectly and stereotypically. They're viewed as being, you know, dens of prostitution and gang activity and whatnot, you know, and I'm not saying that that never happens in a mobile home park. Maybe the bottom 1 or 2% of mobile home parks are bad and tarnish the reputation of the whole industry. But frankly, you know, the bottom couple percent of apartment buildings and site built houses are also bad. But anyway, so, you know, for 98% of the parks where all the rent comes in and there isn't violence and there isn't, you know, there aren't bad things happening, that never makes the news. It's only newsworthy, of course, unfortunately, in our society, it's only newsworthy when bad things happen. So the industry does have an undeservedly bad reputation. Most parks are filled with just hardworking folks trying to make ends meet. Often, you know, they of course want to provide a better life for their kids. They're picking parks in good school districts. We see that sort of thing, that sort of upward mobility all the time. But anyway, so they both have a bad reputation undeservedly. But also, frankly, in America, our propensity to vote scales with our income. So if you make $30,000 a year, as most of our residents do, you're about 30% likely to vote. If you make $100,000 a year, you're about 100% likely to vote. Most elected officials are, you know, middle class and are elected by the middle and upper classes that have a higher propensity to vote. So mobile home park residents don't have a voice generally in all those local city councils. Part of that's their fault, again, that they tend not to vote, but also, you know, quote unquote, only about 5% of Americans live in a mobile home park. Just by the way, about another 5% live in a mobile home on land that they own. So in total, about 10% of all Americans live in a mobile home one way or the other. But about half, 5% roughly, live in a mobile home park. And that, even if they voted 100%, that's, you know, quote unquote, only 5% of the votes, and just probably wouldn't really be enough to change that sort of, you know, negative stereotype and elected officials that know how their bread is buttered. And it's the middle class and upper classes that put them in office. And it's those folks, unfortunately, that look down on those that have less and live in mobile home parks.
Got it. Now the 5%, you know, in the park and 5% of mobile homes on owned land, that statistic, is that something from the census? Is that an industry thing, or is that kind of like a gut feeling?
No, that is from the census. Yeah. And I'm not going to be able to pull it up in front of me right now, but yeah, the census, whatever the Washington bureaucracy is that produces that, they do study housing units and of course, how many people own a house versus rent. And then mobile homes are a sort of subset of all that data that they collect. So, yeah, it's about 5 and 5, and that comes out from those, I believe it's once every year, once every 10 years, once every decade that we do a census.
Got it. You also mentioned the turnover of 2 to 3 years in, you know, in my apartment building deals or my single family rental deals. And that sounds about right. What is the, you know, actual turnover of the person? I mean, you know, they can't all stay there 50 years. Have you guys found it to be, you know, someone stays there for 5 years before they kind of do the Craigslist to sell their unit thing, or 7 years, or have you not measured that yet?
Yeah, so my gut there, we don't yet have the systems in place to measure that. As you can imagine, there are only so many hours in the day trying to keep all your statistics and numbers and whatnot from your business. But yeah, I'm guessing it's going to be an average stay of 7 years. And again, that doesn't mean that we necessarily suffer any vacancy if somebody is moving and bringing in a new tenant. But let's just call it every 7 years that the person moves in and out. Again, the home will almost certainly be in place for about 50. But yeah, the human turnover is about every 7 years.
Cool. So here you go. I'm just going to kind of lay out the timeline, you know, the best of my ability. You obviously know the details, but you were out there in Silicon Valley and you're working on startups, and almost by accident, you discover that you really like the mobile home park business. You buy one and then another one. And then I think, if I remember correctly, somewhere around 2013, you decide that you're going to go after this and really scale up, and you're putting the fund together. And if I'm not mistaken, you've leveraged a podcast to kind of help put the fund together. Can you talk about the transition to, you know, these larger numbers and maybe what the structures look like of the fund and how you've been able to raise money to buy these units or these past parks?
Exactly. Yeah. So the podcast thing happened somewhat, again, more by luck than by plan. I wish I could say I had some grand strategic plan and knew about podcasting right up front. The way we started off was basically just with our own network that was raising money really in early 2014. I have a reasonably high profile on the web if you're looking for somebody in the mobile home park space. So, you know, I knew people, other people at least knew of me. And so really just from networking that way, just posting out some information and letting word circulate that we were starting to raise money, we were able to raise money. In fact, our first several deals were oversubscribed. And then in 2015, we started into the proper fund structure. Those first deals were deal by deal. Obviously separate LLCs, separate investors. And so then in 2015, we started our first official fund. And so it was in 2015 that I then got a call from somebody from Bigger Pockets. This is how it happened. Somebody from the website Bigger Pockets emailed me through the website, letting me know that Bigger Pockets was going to do a podcast on mobile home park investing. So I threw my hand up and they chose me. And so I was on their podcast. And so then it was a couple months later that one of these booking agents, I think, heard me on that podcast. They pulled me onto another show. You know, we started getting leads. We started getting inquiries. And then I asked, I said, hey, do you guys do outbound? Like, that's great that you're pulling me onto a couple of random shows, but like, would you work with me just to promote me as a podcast guest out onto other shows? And so I started working that way with that booking agent. And then that was going so well that then after another couple of months, this now gets to late 2015, that Brad and I decided to do our own podcast, which is simply called Mobile Home Park Investors. So we were the first people ever to podcast about this niche. And our podcast now gets about 12,000 downloads a month, which is great. So we now get, you know, interested investors that have heard our podcast, and we get some deal flow off it. Last fall, we bought a park in Raleigh, Durham, North Carolina, great market. And that came off our podcast. A couple of younger guys in their 20s want to get into the business. They didn't have the money, but they heard our podcast. So they referred us to this deal, and we paid them a nice, oh, I don't know, $75,000 referral fee for bringing us that off market pop park. So the podcast, again, does two things, raises money and some deal flow for us. So we're now a year and a half or more into our podcasting and just about to launch our third fund a little later this year, 2017.
I host the podcast here, and I've done, you know, countless number of deals, had people reach out to me to invest. Not a lot. That's not my main business model, but I've met some of the business partners that I have opened up new markets with directly as a result of people listening to episodes like this and kind of reaching out and showing up at our networking events. And podcasting can be a very powerful tool to leverage the businesses to the next level, certainly in the real estate where deal flow and things of that nature are important.
Yep.
Jefferson, could we discuss, you know, the structure of the fund? Maybe it would be best to kind of talk about the one that you have on the table now. How many pads are you aiming to buy? How many shares at what amount of price? You know, what does an investor have to bring to the table at a minimum amount in order to get involved? Maybe we could just run through those details.
Sure. So folks need to be accredited investors to be in our fund, not if you bring us your own deal that we might invest in jointly. But for most listeners that won't happen to have a good mobile home park for sale, then yeah, you'd need to be an accredited investor to be in our fund. The minimum investment is $50,000. The fund has been paying out around 12% a year, obviously cash, about 3% a quarter. And then appreciation for our investors will be a little lumpy, right? We recognize and distribute the appreciation when we either refinance a property or sell it, but appreciation should probably add another 6 or 8% to our investors' return. So no guarantees here, of course, but probably our investors will make around 20% a year compounded from being in our fund.
And what would be like the total amount of money that's going into one fund, and then how many deals would be necessary before the entire fund is fully invested?
Okay, great question. Yeah, so we keep the funds open typically for a year, sometimes a little less. But our first fund was, we raised $5 million and we bought, I believe it was 7 parks. Our current fund, Fund 2, that we're just closing, has raised right around $14 million. And we've still got a couple of things under contract, and they're larger deals. But our current fund will probably end up buying about 10 properties. And then again, a little later this fall, we'll open up Fund 3, which I would suspect again that we'd raise somewhere between 10 and 20 million and probably buy again 10, 12, 12 properties, something like that. So we're exclusively focused on mobile home parks, of course. We don't also do single family or self-storage or other things, but we do buy broadly. We own literally coast to coast. We've got a property in Spokane, Washington. I mentioned earlier our property in Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina. There's your coast to coast. Most of our stuff, though, is in the greater Midwest. We're in Wyoming. We're in Kansas, Oklahoma, Ohio, Indiana. So most of our purchasing, most of our investing is in the Midwest. So investors do benefit from geographic diversification. Again, we're focused on this niche, but investors will likely then own their proportionate share of parks nationwide, spread out across economies and geographies.
So if we take the 10 park, $14 million middle fund, I'll call it right now. Those 10 parks, are they spread like clean across the country, Jefferson?
They are. In fact, it's that fund that both owns the Spokane, Washington deal and the Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina deal. It also owns up in Minnesota. It also owns down in Florida. So far, we've got one property in Florida, Lakeland, Florida, and working on some more. But yeah, the funds are very similar in that respect, really in most respects. The fund obviously has gotten larger, but both the middle fund and our first fund and even our first deal by deals have a very heavy weighting into the greater Midwest, places where food comes from and where there's light manufacturing and basically, you know, healthy cities and metros in the Midwest is mostly where the capital is invested. But again, it is technically coast to coast.
Are there additional mortgages and debt brought in other than the $14 million to finance or take down these 10 parks?
Yes, there is. We basically get our debt financing from three sources. The two large ones are either bank debt. That would be typically a regional, statewide, or sort of regional bank. And then we also do, for some of our larger properties, we do tap into the CMBS market, which is, you know, the fancy Wall Street debt. And then we have also as a third source, but less significant for us, we have also gotten seller financing. The bank debt we do sign personally on. So Brad and I obviously are putting our personal assets at risk to make the partnership go and generate returns for our limited partners. CMBS financing and a little bit of seller financing that we have do tend to be non-recourse. But we'll get the debt done no matter what it takes to make money for our investors.
And what percentage of the total deal from acquisition cost to value is going to be debt from outside sources? So what portion of the equity position is held right now by the $14 million in the 10-part deal? And then what percentage portion would be loan to value based on not appraisal values, but based on actual cash, you know, purchase prices?
Yeah, so our loan to value, the amount of the debt that comes in to purchase the property has ranged from, I think, 62.5% up to about 75. Our average, I think, is right around 70% debt from whatever source. So on average, we're putting in about 30% equity and again, borrowing about 70%. On average, that's probably the debt is probably a 25-year amortization, probably fixed on average for about 7 years, and on average, probably somewhere right around a 5% interest rate is roughly 5.1% is about where the debt tends to price right now for us.
So does that put us on the middle fund, the $14 million, does that put us purchase price-wise somewhere around $50 million for all 10, or do you happen to know that exact number?
Just to be clear, of our current fund, we have a fairly sizable cash position. As I mentioned earlier, we're closing on three deals, we think, over about the next 60 days. So currently, we've quote-unquote only invested about $10 million of that $14 million. So we have not quite bought that much, yes. And then on two of the deals, we paid all cash. We did that because for the first time ever, we had more cash coming into our fund than good deals. For about the first 3 years of our existence, we always had more good deals than capital. That ratio flipped for us in the first quarter of this year. So we did, and we also got very good pricing on a couple of parks. So our current fund is not fully leveraged. So what we anticipate doing is investing this roughly. So we probably actually invested about $9 million. So we anticipate investing roughly $5 million over the next 60 days. And then we will go back and borrow out probably about another $2.5 million from some of our previous investments. And again, may make another acquisition or two with that. So the current fund is not mature. It's not fully invested. Again, we think it'll be a fully invested fund, call it another, 60 to 90 days down the road.
You might have mentioned already, but the term on that debt, do you have to refinance these mortgages every 5 or 10 years, or do you have a long-term fully amortized loan in place?
Yeah, we've only got, I think, one piece of seller carry that fully amortizes, and I believe it's over 20 years. So a typical scenario is that bank debt runs 5 years and then obviously needs to be refinanced at that point. And bank debt might be either 20 or 25 year amortization. Our CMBS debt, all of it goes 10 years before needing to be refinanced. And all of our CMBS debt is on a 30 year amortization schedule.
Of these acquisitions, are you looking for and have purchased properties that you're going to raise rents or maybe make improvements on and kind of do a little bit of a value add? Or are these typically stable investments where you can just buy them, set them, and forget them?
Yeah, it's a great question. With the kind of numbers we're talking about, we buy typically at about a 9 cap, again, 30% equity, 70% debt. So if you run the math there, we start off at about a 15% cash on cash, which is certainly not bad in today's market. But yeah, we do typically improve the cash flow sometimes. Well, yes, we do raise rents at least something, at least nominally. But we also, for instance, will bill for water. That's a big way to improve your profitability. A lot of the parks we buy are master metered, they just get one big, you know, $6,000-$8,000 water bill every year. And a lot of parks, a lot of previous owners just, you know, have never gotten around to installing meters on the houses, which we think is crazy, because otherwise people obviously tend to waste water, and you don't know if you've got your own leaks in the ground with your pipes between the main meter and the mobile homes. So we do meter for water. That almost always reduces water consumption by about 35%. And wow. Then the remaining, yeah, about a third. And then the remaining 65% of that original water bill under the previous owner, that we've now passed through to the residents. So just billing for water is a great way to improve the profitability. We'll then also, you know, actually a lot of our parks come with at least a couple mobile homes that are just sitting in various states of disrepair. So we'll invest $4,000 to $6,000 in each of those mobile homes, get them fixed up and get them back into the housing pool, obviously, and expand the supply of affordable housing by fixing up those homes. And then we'll also buy brand new homes from the factory and bring those into any vacant pads. Again, typically all the water and sewer and electric and all those utility headers are just stubbed up out of the ground, and it's a fully constructed lot. All we need to do is bring in a house, plop it on top and connect it. And again, it's another revenue stream for us. So again, by actually expanding the supply of affordable housing, that also collectively, all that usually helps us get to about a 20% cash on cash, typically within 6 months of acquisition.
What would be the cost per unit for billing for water? 300, 500? How much does that actually run to install?
So we tend to use meters from a company called SLC Meters. There are other companies out there, but that's who we use mostly. Their meters installed run, I believe, between $300 and $350. And the beauty of that is that those are remote read meters. So our managers, so this all works through, each of them is sort of like a little mini cell phone. Think of it that way. And it's broadcasting water usage back to the company. So what happens there, the great value add is that first we get an alert if there seems to be a leak. Right. If it's, you know, the middle of the night and still there's, you know, however many gallons a minute flowing through the main meter, that almost certainly indicates there's a leak. So we get alerted about leaks. Our tenants can actually log on and see their usage in pretty much real time or maybe in 5 minute increments. But that helps tenants determine if they've got the leak. Most common thing would be like a toilet flap that's not working and just letting gallons of water every minute just flow. But that helps empower our tenants to control their own water bill. And then, of course, our managers can log on and again, see for the whole park who's using what amount of water. And then SLC actually mails a bill, but we'll true that up. They'll get a bill for their water usage from the meter company. And again, our managers can then log on and see how much everybody needs to pay for their usage and make sure we get paid fully. So we're big fans of technology. We use technology a bunch of different ways with our parks. The remote wireless read meters is just one of them. But, you know, it's what's right for the environment, helping to conserve water. It's what's right for our pocketbook. And it's always nice when your pocketbook and the environment all line up.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Jefferson, is there any single idea, system, strategy that you maybe implemented, maybe right in the business and with the units, or maybe, you know, at a higher level over the last year or two that you experienced exponential growth or, you know, just a general improvement in your business as a result?
Yes. So we're now in what we call Mobile Home Park 2.0. Mobile Home Park 1.0. was, you know, epitomized by 3 years ago when Brad and I started and we bought our own, you know, first park. And then we were the asset manager. We were overseeing the crews to rehab the homes. We were calling to get the meters installed. We were producing the water bills. We were doing everything. Mobile Home Park 2.0 is now that we run a real investment business over the last roughly 6 weeks, we've hired a lady who spent a decade working for two of America's top 10 largest mobile home park owners. So she runs all of our asset management. The managers now report to her. She's responsible for all of the billing and revenue and, you know, getting meters installed or getting a park repaved. We've also hired a controller to make sure that our books are done in a more timely manner than, you know, what just Brad and I were able to do on our own. And we've hired on a guy to handle acquisitions for us. He's going to be outreaching both to brokers and to mobile home park owners directly to try and generate more deal flow. So the key thing that I've learned is that while it's nice and even probably necessary to do everything yourself when you get started, the faster you can get to really running a business with, of course, the right people. Got to have the right, the right butts in seats, as I say. You got to have the right people doing those jobs. But the faster you can get to running a business and delegating, having other competent people do things for you, then you can really get to that exponential growth. We think we're going to double in about the next 18 months. So you can have me back on your show late next year, Dan, and see if I've actually done that.
Fair enough. I'll put a notification in the calendar right now.
There we go. All right.
Jefferson, who is the most successful investor, real estate investor, or developer, and why do you believe they're successful?
That's probably Sam Zell. And he's just come out with a great book called Am I Being Too Subtle? Which, of course, is a somewhat tongue-in-cheek title. If you've ever come across Sam Zell or watched a YouTube video of him or whatnot, you know he is the antithesis of subtle. But I think he's probably the greatest. He has, at various times, and I think even all at once 2 years ago or so, he was both the largest owner of office properties through his, I think it's called Equity Office, that REIT. He was also the largest owner of apartment buildings, and that might be Equity Residential, that REIT. And he was and continues to be the largest owner of mobile home parks in America through his Equity Lifestyle REIT. I believe all these are traded on the New York Stock Exchange. Nobody else has ever managed that trifecta of being the largest owner of three asset classes in real estate. But Sam Zell has done it, office, apartment, and mobile home park. So I'm a big fan of his, and actually also a very small shareholder in his mobile home park REIT.
Do you have two or three books that you've recommended most often?
Yes. So Snowball comes to mind. That's the great biography. I think the best biography on Warren Buffett. Again, while I obviously focus on mobile home park investing, I do a little bit of public market investing, and I'm certainly not in Warren Buffett's league. But I do try and learn as much as I can from his business teachings. So Snowball, again, really covers in a very in-depth way his life. It's both, of course, how he invests, but frankly, also some of the trade-offs with his family and some of the personal sacrifices that he made. So Snowball is a great book, I think, to get kind of a holistic and fairly complete view of investing, value investing, and how that fits into your life. Big fan of that. And then I'm about to start Am I Being Too Subtle by Sam Zell. So I would recommend both of those books for anybody interested either specifically in mobile home park or real estate or even just investing generally. I think both of those books are going to be big helps to your listeners.
Nice. And if you could go back to share the crown jewel of wisdom with your younger self, maybe 18, 20 years old, what would that be?
Get into mobile home parks sooner. Yeah, it took me until age 39 to buy my first park. I'm not saying don't ever work for other people. You know, I did work for other folks, obviously, for about 20 years, my 20s and 30s. And I got varying levels of benefit from working for other folks. Some of those jobs were quite helpful, others not as much. I probably, if I had known then what I knew now, I probably could have gotten into the business more like in my early 30s. I think I still probably would have worked for other folks and learned about investing in my 20s as I did. But I could have gotten into the business, yeah, probably 8 years earlier, something like that. And I would have then started raising money much more quickly. When I first got into the business at 39, I really viewed myself as a value investor, obviously investing my own capital in value real estate. And it took me about 5 years, frankly, to have a mind shift and then start realizing that really I should view myself as a money manager, managing money in value real estate, mobile home parks specifically, but shifting away from thinking, hey, I'm going to do this entirely on my own, to then thinking, hey, I'm going to manage other people's money. I won't get all the profits. We'll split it. But obviously, OPM, I can grow a lot faster with other people's money. Anyway, I should have shifted more quickly into that, into managing other people's money and grown more quickly beyond just my own limited capital base.
If anybody is listening and would like to check out maybe your podcast or get some more information about you, do you have something you'd like to share or direct the listeners to?
Yeah, so a couple of things. So we've got a website just for our podcast, and I also actually run the largest group on LinkedIn, about 3,700 members just for mobile home park investing. Anyway, our website, which you can link to all this, is simply called mobilehomeparkinvestors.com. And folks there will find links, again, both to our podcast and to our group on LinkedIn. And they should certainly feel free to connect to me on LinkedIn. So that's mobilehomeparkinvestors.com. And then for anybody that might want to specifically, explore investing in our fund or just learn a little more about our partnership, our website is parkstreetpartners.com, parkstreetpartners.com.
All right. Well, that brings us to the top of the hour here. I appreciate you giving your time and coming on the show. I know tons of great information here myself. Can't wait to hop on Sam Zell's book at your recommendation. So thank you for coming on the show, Jefferson.
Dan, it's been great to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamond Show. Are you interested in receiving a notification when I release the next episode? You can either sign up for email at www.reidiamonds.com or subscribe to one of the podcasting apps, including iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We also have a link for expert guests to apply to come on the show at www.reidiamonds.com. And if you are interested in selling a deal to me or buying a deal from me in one of my markets, please go to that page at www.reidiamonds.com and click the link. I am currently looking for deals in the Philadelphia tri-state area, Baltimore, Maryland, D.C. market, the Chicagoland region, the Atlanta region, and the Tampa Bay area in Florida. Do you know anybody else who might also enjoy this episode? I appreciate the referrals, and I'm sure that they would too. Last but not least, I appreciate you, my loyal REI Diamond Show listener. Dan Breslin here. I'll catch you later.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.